How difficult is it actually to become an artist? I mean, well, at what point do you actually decide, say, this is what I want to do with my life?
Well, I think it's just as difficult as anything in any other walks of life. It's either you want to do it or you don't. And if you want to do it badly enough, you just get on with it, you know?
Can you tell us a bit about how you came to be an artist and some of the ups and downs that you've had and your road to, you're now becoming pretty well known. It must have been quite a long and choppy path.
Yeah, it is. It's always a long path anyway. You need to work, and you need to be, in a way, quite single-minded about it and love to do it. And you need a lot of luck to come as well, your way as well. It's all of that.
Tell us a story about how you first got into art school by the skin of your teeth.
Yeah, it was by the skin of my teeth. That was to do with when I was at Gall here in Cambridge, and we had a very, very good art teacher called Mervyn Rowe, I remember his name. He loved to paint, and I got very influenced by him. He liked my drawings, liked my paintings, and one day he said, "Have you ever thought of being a painter? You know, you paint well." And I said, "Yeah, sure. I'd love to be a painter, you know." And he said, "Well, okay, well, why don't we put a portfolio together and get yourself an interview at the Cambridge School of Art?" This was in 1963 or 64, I can't remember. Anyway, you know, something like that. And probably 64. He helped me to put a portfolio together of drawings and paintings that I'd been doing over the years with him, and got myself an interview. I was just, not 16 yet. And when I got to the interview with the head and the vice head at the Cambridge School of Art, there was, I remember, you know, there were very little places for quite a lot of people applying. And one of the things the head said to me, which was Alec Heath, a very strict disciplinarian and a good man anyway, he said to me, "Why do you want to come here?" So I said, "I want to paint." So what happened was, after he looked at my portfolio and did a lot of humming and whatever and all this and that, he said, "Well, how many qualifications do you have then, boy?" Because he used to talk like that, you know, actually, boy. So I said, "Well, I haven't got any." He said, "Well, why the hell haven't you got any? You know, we need qualifications here." So I said, "Well, I haven't got any O-levels yet because I'm doing my mocks, you know, taking them next year." So and he says, "Well, you're no bloody good to us then, are you? So we need qualifications here. So why don't you just go back, and when you get some, give us another go." So as I was walking out the door with my portfolio, he said, "Hang on a minute, you're doing, it's the last days of these 3 days exams that you're doing here, aren't they? You know, entrance exams." I said, "Yeah. You know, one day we had life drawing, the next day we had, a setup of still life, and that day was finishing off a composition that they gave us three titles." So I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, go and finish that off, and then don't bother us until you've got some qualifications." So I said, "Okay, thanks very much," and left thinking nothing would happen. 2 months later in the summer, I got a letter from them saying, "You're in." So I got in there through this sort of loophole, only because he decided he liked my drawings, and I suppose that I said I wouldn't be a painter. You know, that was it, really.
I know your paintings are very well recognised. You've been entered for various competitions and exhibitions. Can you tell us a bit about your sort of road to success, as it were, as an artist?
Well, that's never easy, and also you don't really think about a road to success. You know, that's always so far away. You know, there are famous artists that, you know, you think you'll never get anywhere near them. And, you know, all you do is carry on. You paint. And there are bad times when you feel, which is most of the time, when you feel like you're not doing anything worthwhile and it's no good. And this is the point where you need someone. Every now and then you need someone that has some faith in you, in someone outside. In my case, number one, and always has been, is the girl that became my wife, Susie. You know, we've been married now for since 1970, and I've known her a little bit before then, and she never ever doubted that I could, you know, that I loved painting and that I should carry on with it. And in between then, I was involved in, you know, working as a waiter, running a family business in a restaurant and so on to keep us going. And then, you know, then I got my first exhibition in 1969. This chap came around and bought three paintings, who I later found out was Jim Ead from Kettle's Yard. We became good friends, and then he was another one who had faith in me, so to speak. He became like my mentor. Yeah, well, I used to see him two or three times a week, and he'd take me around Kettle's Yard talking to me about all the pieces he'd acquired and the friends he's had and the artists and so on. And that was the thing. Those are the things that kept me going.
Can you tell us a little bit about your paintings? You say they're figurative.
Yeah, well, I only say that because if, for instance, people want to label you as somebody or something, like they'll ask you, you know, what you do, you say, I paint, you know, that's what I say usually, I paint, and sometimes I think you go and painting up, you know, the outside of houses or whatever, I ask you to decorate the house, that's fine, but usually once they find out that you paint pictures, so to speak, they say, what do you paint, which is, you know, something that you can't really answer, it's a visual thing, but what I can say is that I say to them, well, I'm a figurative painter, I paint, my things are based on the figure, whether they are figures or whether they are landscapes, they're based on something which I call figurative. And then they might slowly become, after time, things become abstracted, but they always come out of something that I call figurative.
You have kind of landscapes, but lots of other things in them. What is it that you try to actually do to the eye with one of these paintings, that magnificent one you've got over there?
There's a large painting, yes, over there, which is, it's not really a theme. I don't paint in themes. It is a landscape, but there's figures in it, and the landscape itself is called Ascending Landscape. It's one of several I've been doing, and I only think of it as a theme because every time I give an exhibition, I do more than about three or four works on the same sort of thing. An art critic coming to write about it will call it a theme. I never think of it like that. But anyway, the thing is, that particular work, which is a landscape, and it comes from my walking around a certain landscape in Andalusia, in southern Spain. The first time I went there in the mid-60s, I was taken there by a good friend. I fell in love with the landscape. I did lots of drawings of the landscape. It's almost like a moonscape. I don't know. It's a mountainous, very mountainous, and completely different from the area, as you know, where I live, which is fenland, you know, flat. I fell in love with these mountains and the fields and so on. And what I'm trying to do in these paintings is actually, I'm painting from memory almost. You know, from my feelings and smells, that walking around that landscape, how I felt about it. I like to do my paintings away from the actual place. Absolutely, yeah, it's a slow process. And what happens is, many people always think that they see these very colorful paintings sometimes and very mountainous landscapes, and they think that I've actually painted them there, which is completely wrong. In fact, I think if I did paint the mountains there, when I was in Andalusia, they'd just get in the way. You know, there'd be no room left for the imagination. What I like to do is go out maybe with a sketchbook and do skeletal drawings, just line, very linear drawings, no colour at all. I come back to the studio here, locked up in this sort of middle of Cambridge, and I look at the drawings and I start to do more drawings, and then I remember the colours, I remember the atmosphere, I remember the dark blues, the greys, the reds, and they become very much more exaggerated in my mind. So I'm able to then come up with things which I could never do there, but they're not trying to be representational of the place. They're trying to get more of how one feels and the atmosphere. Walking around a place like that, you know, the love of it.
I have a very warm kind of feeling of aesthetics. You're explaining to me your the way that you go through several stages in actually painting and using both sides of the paper and what have you to achieve that. Is that something that you feel, I mean, it has that very friendly feeling to the painting. How do you achieve that? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. Let me tell you to begin with that my love of painting or paper, I mean, I love that much more than on canvas, because it's much more alive. Paper is made, you know, by hand, you know, one can make it, you know, yourself and so on. I found this quite by accident. This paper, it originally comes from Tibet. I think now it's made in Nepal. And it was made Tibetan monks, you know, for their Sanskrit. And I was given an exhibition once in Kettle's Yard in 1974, and this chap came around with a whole roll of it, and he was looking at my paintings, and I was following him, feeling this roll of paper under his arms. I eventually, you know, bought it from him and tried to paint. Very difficult to paint on. It was, you know, crinkling and so on. But I found a way it's a thing you have it's material you have to learn to go with rather than against, you know, and it's not as hard as canvas. It's got its own fibers. It's very uneven. It does all sorts of strange things. And I just came by accident. I paint on both sides of it. It's because sometimes it's so thin, the paint, it takes oils very well, and it's so thin the paint goes right through it. And then on the other side you get this very subtle, very beautiful shades of any color you put on. Then I turn it around and I zap it up by painting on the other side. So at the end there's hardly any of the paper left. It's just sort of a paint on both sides. But, you know, it's a beautiful quality that I found.
Also, obviously, new to another thing you're very keen on doing. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, well, that the nudes came about because we did so much life drawing at art school in the 60s. I'm probably one of the last generation of students then that actually did a lot of life drawing, and we had to do that. It was part of the curriculum, and you get used to doing that, and it becomes, you very quickly feel, and you get to know that everything comes out of the human form. If you can go anywhere near in drawing the human physique, whether it's male or female, because it's so sophisticated, it's the most sophisticated animal, then drawing something like a cow or a sheep is that easy, you know, I mean, it's only very easy shapes. So therefore, number one, I wanted to keep up the life drawing, you know, but number two, I love to do the nudes because they have, to me, the same sort of feeling as if the curvature of mountains and so on, or just to do the nude for its own sake, it's a beautiful thing to do, especially the female nude. And my wife, Susie, was always the best inspiration for that. You have to get to know a person well, I think, before you can actually draw them, paint them. And once you do get to know somebody like that, then you never tire of painting them.
Now, you've got a couple of paintings which are travelling around the country at the moment. Can you tell us a little bit about those? And also, what members of the people who've seen your paintings usually come back and say to you? I mean, what kind of impression do you think you've made on other people?
Well, that's always hard to say for the artists themselves. You know, it's always for other people to say. But I don't know. It's always quite surprising when you find that somebody knows your work or knows of you, because an artist is usually stuck in their studio, you know, like a monk in a monastery, you know, or a recluse, just painting away. You don't know. I mean, I never knew at all what happens to my paintings once they get sold and taken away. They're hanging somewhere, they're ticking away somewhere. And the only time I ever actually got to know about any of these things was when my agent, my gallery, Christopher Hull, who's in London, said to me, oh, well, you know, I know that you're talked about so many times, you know, in a day, for instance, or whatever, because of the people who have your paintings. They come and talk to me about it. They come, you know, and so on. So I met a lot of the people that buy my paintings, and some of them come back and they get more and so on. And it's always good to know that once the painting is gone, somebody has it and is hopefully loving it and stuck it on a wall somewhere and looking at it, because that's the only way, you know, once you've finished with it, it's the only way it can live, by other people looking at it and liking it, perhaps, you know.
Are these paintings very much there for you to kind of interact with in your own way?
Yeah, very much, because I feel very much that I'm still walking around that landscape, and I feel very much I want to be part of it and be right in it. So this particular painting, which is Ascending Landscape, I call it, is to do with the very first time I was in Andalusia and doing a lot of drawing of this old dried riverbed. You know, I was looking down from above, from a village I was staying, and you looked at this dried riverbed which was curving around the mountains, and then you saw banks and banks of mountains and nothing else. Hardly any sky at all if you look down, and by drawing this continually over and over again, you begin to simplify, and you start to see that when you come to the studio that you're still making similar strokes, which means that you haven't really sorted out that painting. You still want to find out more about it, you know, and then it changes, but essentially you're keeping...
Is it a heart-wrenching experience letting some of your paintings go?
Absolutely. I think it's always that, because you're living with them, you're working with them, and they are your things that you've, tried to do. If one particularly works, you know, every now and then you get one that with everything coming together, that's when inspiration comes into it, if there is such a thing. People tend to think that an artist sits around all day on their bums until you're inspired and then you get up and do a painting, which is absolutely wrong. You have a lot of perspiration, you just get in there and you work. But every now and then, once in a blue moon, something goes right and your drawing comes out. You can almost do no wrong. Something's happening and everything is flowing. When that happens, you carry on painting because you know it's not going to happen tomorrow. And usually the painting that comes out from that day, usually could be just a day's work, in my case anyway, then you end up with a painting that, work that could be something special. That one you always feel is very hard to let go, but that's usually the one that everybody else wants as well.
Now money is the bane of an artist's life. What lengths have you been driven to actually survive financially as an artist when you perhaps haven't been able to sell painting?
Oh, washing dishes, you know, the usual thing. Working in restaurants. I'm very lucky that my family had a restaurant, you know, and as probably a very good restaurant called The Gardenia here, which was fun to run as well. So I didn't quite starve. There was always food around. But you had to work, you know, to make money as a waiter. You know, I'd work and I'd get tips, and in the days when they used to leave tips. And I used to... It was also much... In those days, I'm talking about, 20-odd years ago, it was easier to live. You know, there was not so much pressure. I mean, somehow got by doing that. But yes, it's very difficult because you can't go out and sell a painting. You know, it's a luxury item. People have got to go out and buy their eggs and bacon for their children before they're going to go and bloody well spend some money for a painting. So, you know, you mustn't think about it. You've got to go out and do other work most of the time. And you're very lucky if you can make a living from your work full time. I have been, in one way, quite lucky that I didn't have to go out teaching, or which a lot of artists have to do. I prefer to work in a restaurant and then paint, you know, the rest of the time.
What would you say to anyone who is starting out in life and they perhaps want to have a feeling that that's the kind of thing they'd like to do? What would you say to them about that?
Well, I'm not a person that gives advice to anybody. I wouldn't give advice to anybody at all. But you know, all I can say is that from my own experience, if one wanted to be a painter or artist of any sort, you know, sculpting or whatever, you must want to do it badly enough. You've got to really think, eat, drink it, you know, all day. Even when I can't get near some paper or a canvas, or I'm traveling or whatever now, in a day, I'm still creating paintings in my head and destroying them. So you've got to be hungry, in a way. So the only thing I can say is that you've got to really look inside you and want to do it, and then other things will come. Then you'll find other ways of sorting yourself out and living. You know, you'll go and work anywhere, washing dishes or washing cars or windows or God knows what. I've been a milkman. And then the rest of the time, especially when you're young, you don't have to sleep. Oh, I can't remember sleeping much when I was younger. You then do your paintings and you just carry on until perhaps you can get an exhibition somewhere.
And what about now? How much are your paintings selling for at the moment?
Well, selling, again, that's in the realms of people who control all these things. Artists never put prices on their paintings, really. Not the ones I know of. It's all to do with what they call the art market, whatever that is. And it's all usually controlled by a clique and a little mafia going on somewhere. And they decide that your paintings are worth this or that. My paintings, I don't know what they're worth. at all if they're worth anything or what, but I paint them, and they're being sold for anything between, you know, small watercolour of £700-800 to a largish oil painting on paper or whatever for £10,000 or £15,000. I've sold for more than that, you know, for 20 and so on. But it all depends on, you know, as well, the gallery you're with, you know, the all sorts of things which are not in the control of artists. What artists do is paint in their studios, and they're not really very good at talking to agents or art galleries. Agents don't particularly want to talk to artists. They'd like to talk to other agents and buyers and so on. So you just get on with it, and then suddenly your paintings have been sold for this or that. There's a lot of hype in it, you know. I mean, what is art? You know, it for the artist's point of view, that it's something that you have to do and you want to do and you love to do. For the commercial side of it, it's all hype. You know, if somebody comes up like Saatchi or somebody like that, who is quite powerful in the art world, or Leo Castelli in New York, and says, this guy is good, I say he's good, or she's good, or whatever, and then they've got everybody running around trying to buy their paintings for enormous amounts of money. Whether they're worth it or not is neither here nor there.
What do you think of the local galleries in Cambridge? Do we need a new place? Is it?
Yes, I'm. Well, all I can say about Cambridge is that Cambridge is such a powerful place in a way with everything else. It's a great university. It's one of the best addresses in the world, in a way. You know, everybody knows Cambridge and Oxford, and yet the visual arts have never really been able to flourish. Although there are a huge amount of artists in Cambridge, you know, whatever they are, and all around East Anglia, it's really a surprise that the visual arts and big galleries have never been able to sustain themselves in Cambridge. There are, well, you know, there's Kettle's Yard, of course, which, you know, was a private thing by a great collector, Jim Ead, and that was left to the university. And there are a few other little galleries here and there. CCA Gallery is very good, and it's beginning to bring new people in. But there should be much more in Cambridge. There should be more genuinely, you know, robust sort of galleries in Cambridge, which I'm afraid that has never been the case.
There's a lot of money is being invested in Cambridge at the moment in high-tech industries, and there'll probably be quite a lot of people quite soon around the town who've got the kind of money to spend that would enable them to buy paintings like yours. Have you got any hopes of that at all for yourself and other artists locally?
Yeah, well, that's a good question in a way, because I remember from the experience of my first exhibition, not my first exhibition in Cambridge, but the one I had in Kettle's Yard in 74, I remember giving a show there, where nothing was sold. Absolutely nothing was sold. Fair enough. It didn't particularly bother me or anything like that. But that was the year that I got attached to Christopher Hull, who was then in the gallery, who was then in the Fulham Road. He saw my paintings and asked me to give an exhibition a few months later after the Kettle's Yard show. Now, what I found was the same people, a lot of the same people who came to Kettle's Yard and saw my show there, came to London. And because they thought they were with a decent gallery, a blue chip gallery in London, my work was being exhibited there, they came and they bought the paintings for three times the price that they were exhibited for at Kettle's Yard. I asked one or two of them why the hell they didn't buy them, you know, there, because the gallery was obviously putting more money on and he has to get his commission and so on. But I think what it was to do with sort of not having enough confidence to buy from what they considered a provincial place that had nothing much to do with the art world. But they were much more unafraid to go to London to a known gallery and spend more money and buy something with their stamp on it, so to speak. It's human nature.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, I don't know, really. I mean, there's almost too much that one can say. I can ramble on for ages about all sorts of things. But really, as far as working as a painter is concerned, it's a very lonely business, like a writer, I would imagine, or a musician, or whatever. Most of the arts are quite lonely, and you're stuck, as you see, in this studio, which I like to be, with your thoughts and your materials, and you mess around, and you do things. You try to keep yourself amused, because you're by yourself. You try to, every now and then, excite yourself. Every now and then you try and take a risk or two when you think the painting is okay or quite good. You might take a deep breath and do something with it that will either destroy it or make it a better painting. And this is the things that I like to do. And later on, when the light's gone, I can't do any more, and you can't do any more painting, you can't do any more work, I like to go out and see friends and be with people and drink and so on.
Renas Lozier, thank you very much indeed, Phil, for spending some time to talk to us.
Thanks very much, Sam.